As we wrap up 2025, one thing's clear. Uncertainty isn't temporary. It's the world we live in now. Noble Gold Investments helps Americans protect what they've built with real gold and silver, holding value when everything else feels uncertain. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and take your first step toward a safe future. This holiday season, when you open up a qualified account, you'll receive 10 one-ounce commemorative silver holiday coins. Visit Noble Gold today.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
So we all know I've watched a lot of Law & Order over the years. If there's one thing I've taken away from it, it's that a prosecutor loves direct evidence. A bloody fingerprint, a witness who saw the crime, a recorded confession, a smoking gun that conclusively tells the jury, this is the guy or girl. But that's not always how the cookie crumbles. Believe it or not, many cases find their way to the courtroom based on circumstantial evidence alone. Maybe someone was in the same place around the same time as the crime, or someone overheard the defendant having a suspicious conversation. Circumstantial evidence is tricky because it requires a sharp jury to draw their own conclusions based on what's presented. And it makes getting conviction that much more difficult. In today's case, circumstantial evidence was pretty much the only thing a jury had to work with, particularly because one of the best witnesses in the case changed their story just days leading up to the trial, and then mysteriously wound up dead themselves. It's Christmas morning in Madison, Wisconsin, 1977. And yes, I did pick this episode for the holiday season. An otherworldly temperature of 22 below zero has descended upon the capital city overnight. Over the last few weeks, Madison was pummeled with 8 inches of snow, which still framed the icy roads because it was that cold. But it made Christmas all the more magical for the children at home, opening up their gifts from Santa back in the 70s. And if you asked 31-year-old Jerry Davies, however, he had a little idea what day it was. As his Chevrolet whipped down Madison's abandoned streets, he wondered for a moment why the roads were so clear. But the thought escaped his mind as soon as he pulled into the empty parking lot of the Madison Police Department. Crunching through old, dirty snow, he stomped up to the front door and swung it open. Christmas carols played softly in the background as he approached the tinsel-covered duty desk window. An officer, not expecting to be caught stuffing Christmas cookies in his mouth at 10 a.m. that morning, was shocked to find the distraught Jerry Davies looming over him. And then the words came pouring out of Jerry. I don't know who it was, but last night, I buried a man in a snowbank. It was around 10:40 a.m. when a phone rang in the house, just a few miles down from the precinct. Detective Chuck Lolling was standing in his bathrobe, drinking from a mug that read, "My favorite cop is a grandpop." He and his wife were preparing for the arrival of their grandchildren. Lolling's heart sank. There was only one place that could be calling him on Christmas morning, and he knew it was going to ruin his day. Minutes after taking the call, Detective Lolling was rushing upstairs for his uniform. When he returned to the kitchen, he kissed his wife and extended his apologies. "Save me some Christmas dinner," he said. "Apparently, a man buried a body in a snowbank last night, and he's offering the tickets there." So within the next few hours, Detective Lolling and several other Madison PD vehicles were pulling up to the entrance of the Black Hawk ski jump. They could all see their breath as Jerry Davies, the man who wandered into the police, led them by foot further towards a snowbank just off the road. Almost immediately, Lolling saw what they'd come for, an arm jutting out of the packed snow, the fingers clenched as if he had been holding something. As the officers got closer, they could see the victim had suffered several blows to the face and head. And oddly enough, the only piece of clothing he was wearing was a wristwatch. Slowly, the police removed the body from the densely packed snow, preparing to take it in for an autopsy, and that's when Lolling heard a retching sound behind him. Jerry Davies, unable to stand the sight of the man that he left out there, was now vomiting all over the crime scene. Jerry Davies wasn't cut out for whatever was about to come his way. He'd spent his entire life in Madison, Wisconsin, and other small rural communities in the area. He even went to college at the University of Wisconsin, only to quit after 3 semesters. He eventually took a job at the university's audiovisual department, but Jerry could never venture far away from home. He was a mama's boy. He went to his hometown of Spring Green every weekend to check in on her, which is where he should have been this morning, probably eating a giant ham devastating guilt hadn't led him to the Madison Police Department, where he was now spilling his guts to a room full of strangers. In fact, Jerry was so visibly distraught by the situation that officers had him examined by a doctor. All right, folks, quick moment before we dive back in. If you love what we're doing here and you want to help us take True Crime Never Sleeps to that next level, you can support the show over at buymeacoffee.com/TCNS. Every contribution, whether it's the cost of a cup of coffee or something bigger, goes directly into making this show even better. And I don't just mean better audio. Your support helps us upgrade our gear, invest in sharper, more in-depth investigations, and even bring on additional hosts so we can tell these stories with the attention and quality they deserve. We're building something bigger here, and you can be a real part of that. Plus, one of our long-term goals is to take this show on the road. Live recordings from infamous crime scenes and locations across the country, letting you experience these stories in a totally different way. Travel, research, production, food, it all adds up. And that's exactly what your donations make possible. So if you want to help us expand, grow, and keep delivering content that actually keeps you thinking long after the episode ends, head on over to buymeacoffee.com/TCNS and chip in if you can. It genuinely makes a difference. All right, let's get back to the episode. First, Detective Lolling was annoyed that this man had ruined his holiday with his family, but now, honestly, he kind of felt sorry for him. Jerry was sobbing, hyperventilating, and had a hard time getting the words out. He insisted he had no idea who the man in the snowbank was, only that he'd helped someone else put the body there. And that someone was his fiancée, a woman named Barbara Hoffman. Jerry had met Barbara in the most unusual places, and I'm using quotes here. A massage parlor in Madison, a place called Jan's that offered a lot more than you paid for, if you know where I'm going. But Jerry wasn't the kind of guy that just stumbled into one of these massage parlors. It took him 3 days and several six-packs to wake up the courage to finally try it out. 3 years earlier, back in 1973. See, Jerry was a bit inexperienced when it came to sex. At that point, he was about 28 years old and never been with a woman before. Jan's Health Spa seemed like the perfect place to just rip off the band-aid. And when he came for his third appointment, oh man, I mean, when he walked in for his third appointment, he was introduced to a masseuse named Barbara Hoffman. Immediately, Jerry was entranced by Barbara. She didn't bat her lashes and play coy with him like the other girls had. She was strong, assertive, dominant, if you will. She was considered the queen of the massage parlor. And unlike the other workers, she talked to him. She got to know who he really was. And the more he fell for her, the more frequent a customer he became. Over time, it became less about the sexual favors he was paying for and more about the emotional connection that they were forming at his appointments. And shockingly, it wasn't all in his head, because Barbara eventually asked Jerry if he wanted to spend some time with her outside of Jan's. From there, the relationship took off, to the point where Barbara quit working at the parlor in May of 1976 and got a job as a receptionist at a medical insurance firm. It's pretty crazy that worked out, because, I mean, what a weird place to actually meet. But there were a few red flags. Still, none of this stopped Jerry from proposing to his first true love, and shockingly, Barbara accepted his proposal. However, by December 1977, as you know, things had gotten pretty weird, and the wedding plans were still up in the air. Which brings us back to that Christmas afternoon where Jerry finally composed himself enough to open up to Detective Lolling and explain the events that led up to that snowbank that morning. Well, Jerry says that two nights prior, on the evening of December 23rd, he was heating up dinner when the phone rang. It was Barbara, asking him if he wanted to come over and watch some TV on her couch. Now, Jerry's a bit surprised to hear from her because he'd just driven her to work earlier that day, and he specifically asked if he was going to see her before she went to her parents for the holiday. But she said no, she had too much to do.
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Excuse me. Still, when she calls him to come over to her apartment that night, he drops everything. And by 9:30 p.m., the two are snuggled up on her couch, drinking and watching Johnny Carson. A little while later, Jerry dozes off, but then he wakes up around 2:30 a.m. It's now Christmas Eve morning. To a suddenly frantic Barbara, she's saying, "Jerry, wake up. I need to talk to you about something." She claims that yesterday, when she got home from work, she found a dead body in her bathroom, and she now needs Jerry, her fiancé's, help to get rid of it. And somehow, Jerry didn't see this dead body before. So now Jerry, who's still half asleep, must be wondering if this is some sort of bad dream. But he's still using his head better than Barbara, because he's like, if you found a dead body, let's call the police. And Barbara's like, no, absolutely not. How is she going to explain to the cops that this dead body just happened to show up in her apartment? Now, Jerry said she seemed scared and adamant that the shady people who ran Jan's massage parlor were behind the whole thing. So after this, Jerry just kind of follows his fiancé's lead. When he asks her where the body is now, Barbara says she moved it downstairs and out back near the dumpsters. She tells Jerry, "Go get your car, meet me out back, and we'll just get the body off the property." After that, they drove to the Blackhawk ski jump and left the man there, packing him tightly in the snow. The entire ride home, they sat in silence. Jerry was too afraid to ask any questions. And when he finally got back to her place, she got out, told Jerry to clean his car, and sent him away. Barbara obviously had no idea that in 30 more hours, Jerry would be overcome with guilt and replaying the entire scene for the Madison Police Department. Shockingly, the police wasted no time getting a search warrant for Barbara's apartment, particularly for a holiday. By Christmas afternoon, they were forcing their way into Barbara's now empty home. What they found was nothing. No forced entry, no signs of a dead body, no struggle of any kind, no strange smells, no blood, no fluids. Police did end up collecting a few items, some dirty clothing, towels, and a few pieces of mail addressed to a woman named Linda Miller. But for the most part, it looked as though the deceased had never even entered Barbara's apartment. Come 9 p.m., though, there was a major break in the case. The identity of the deceased man had been revealed. A woman had called the police to say that her brother, a single man with no wife, no kids, and not very many friends, had not shown up for their Christmas festivities. Rather than digging into their Christmas dinner, she and her husband were driving down to Madison to confirm the identity of a dead body. And sure enough, it was her brother, a 52-year-old man named Harold Burge. Around the same time that night, police had tracked down the location of Barbara Hoffman. She'd been spending Christmas evening at her parents' house in Park Ridge, Wisconsin, about an hour and 45 minutes away from Madison. When they knocked on the door, they asked if she would come down to the station. Barbara went willingly, but after finding out what she was there for, she refused to answer any questions without her lawyer. And honestly, the police had underestimated Barbara Hoffman. She was a lot smarter and more calculated than most people knew. When the now 25-year-old Barbara began working at Jan's Massage Parlor back in 1974, she was still a senior at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She was, she'd been majoring in biochemistry, had a 3.9 GPA, and was fluent in three different languages. But that year, something changed. She took that job at Jan's, and on November 15, 1974, just 12 credits shy of completing her degree, Barbara dropped out of school. Even stranger, she didn't seem to have any real friends, no one who knew her or spent time with her outside of work other than Jerry Davies and now possibly the murder victim, Harold Burge. The following day, December 26th, Harold's body had thawed enough for a pathologist to perform an autopsy. And here's what they found. Harold had suffered multiple blunt force injuries to the head and neck, resulting in severe brain damage. He had what appeared to be fingernail scratches at the base of his neck. Vomit was present in his nose, mouth, and lungs. But his cause of death was ruled to be blunt force trauma to the head. What was strange, however, was that if Harold had been in Barbara's apartment the night of his death, there was zero sign of it. Upon returning to Barbara's place, a forensic team scrubbed every inch looking for hairs, fibers, blood, fingerprints, any shred of physical evidence that Harold had ever been inside. They found nothing. Even if Barbara had done a rigorous cleanup job, investigators used ultraviolet lights and other tools that would have revealed where blood or bodily fluids had recently been cleaned. There was nothing. Police were certain of one thing, though. Barbara and Harold were not strangers. As they dug deeper, they discovered Harold, a chronically single middle-aged man, shared a lot of the same qualities as Jerry. He didn't have many friends, had never had a serious girlfriend, and he had frequented Jan's massage parlor. And who did he request? Barbara Hoffman. Apparently, like Jerry, the two had begun seeing each other outside of the parlor. And that's when Harold Burge made some pretty wild, life-changing decisions. He adjusted the deed to his home to include the name of his now new fiancée, a woman named Linda Miller, who he also made his sole heir. He then changed his life insurance policies to make Linda the beneficiary, totaling $34,000. And if the name Linda Miller sounds familiar, it should, because it was written on some of the mail found inside Barbara Hoffman's apartment. Linda Miller was the name Barbara had assumed after she left the massage parlor for her new job. She wanted a fresh start, free of any associations from her sordid past. She had it changed legally, complete with a savings account, a social security number, and now a very clear motive for getting rid of Harold Burge. Now detectives were looking at two men from Jan's massage parlor, both socially isolated, both emotionally attached to Barbara Hoffman, and both now linked to her financially. Detective Lowling was pretty sure he'd figured the whole thing out, and if Jerry Davies agreed to be the chief witness in the case, then he was certain they'd have Barbara behind bars in no time for the murder of Harold Burge. The theory was this. Barbara had been engaged to two men at the same time. She used Harold to get money, his house, his life insurance, and once that plan was complete, she killed him. Then she was going to run away with Jerry. But even with all of this, everything was still circumstantial. So after piecing together Harold's last few days on Earth, here's the scenario Detective Lowling came up with. On the evening of December 22nd, Harold attended the annual Christmas party for the Uniroyal Tire Plant, where he worked as a forklift operator. After enjoying the buffet, Harold said goodbye, headed over to his fiancée's Barbara's apartment around 9 p.m. This would explain why Barbara could only see Jerry once or twice a week, because she was entertaining another fiancé. At some point that evening, the couple likely had an argument. Maybe it was about Jerry. Either way, it turned violent. Barbara clawed at Harold's neck as he fought back. Eventually, she grabbed something, possibly a frying pan, hit him over the head again and again. Perhaps she didn't intend to kill him, but one of those blows proved fatal. Barbara panicked. She stripped Harold of his clothes and deep-cleaned her apartment. Later that night, when no one was around, she dragged his body out behind the dumpster, accounting for the additional bruising found on Harold's legs and lower back during the autopsy. But the following day, she realized there was no way she could get Harold into a car by herself. Rigor mortis had set in, and the freezing temperatures made him impossible to move. That's when she enlisted the help of fiancé number two, Jerry Davies. At least, that was the theory. Problem was, there was still no direct evidence connecting Barbara to the death of Harold Burge. The only witness was a neighbor, an engineering student, who claimed he spotted Barbara on the morning of December 23rd, before Jerry Davies was made aware of the crime. The witness said he saw Barbara getting rid of a car that wasn't hers, backing it up next to the dumpster behind the apartment complex. Later, he said he saw her taking a basket full of dirty clothes outside. Detectives theorized this was when Barbara attempted to move the body herself, only to realize she couldn't do it alone. But the neighbor didn't see her moving a body, didn't see her committing a crime, didn't hear anything suspicious. And that left open the possibility, however unlikely, that Barbara was telling the truth, that someone connected to Jan's massage parlor had framed her. This theory gained some traction when investigators learned that after Barbara quit Jan's, she allegedly took several of their clients and began seeing them out of her own apartment, keeping the full percentage for herself. That alone could have made her enemies. Still, Detective Lowling and his team found that explanation hard to believe. Between the life insurance policy and the changes to Harold's home deed, it appeared Barbara had been trying to cash out. And on January 18, 1978, Barbara Hoffman was arrested for the murder of Harold Burge. Only 3 days later, she was released on a $115,000 bail. Barbara Hoffman was now a free woman awaiting her day in court. But this made Detective Lolling nervous, particularly for Jerry Davies. In February, Lolling went to Jerry, urged him to cut ties with Barbara, maybe even leave town altogether. He felt certain that if Jerry wasn't careful, he would be her next victim. Because at this point, Barbara knew the prosecutor's number one piece of evidence against her was Jerry Davies. Then around March 24th, the Madison Police Department received a letter with no return address. The handwritten note inside read, "I want to set the record straight. I was scared. I was jealous. Barb is innocent. And I wrecked her life." The letter was from Jerry Davies. It claimed that the stories he had told police during his confession were all lies. That Barbara had nothing to do with the death of Harold Burge. And that he was the one responsible. So this changes things a bit. Police just start to think, maybe this would make sense. Maybe Jerry did find Harold in Barbara's apartment, learned about who he was, got so angry that he took the man's life. Maybe Barbara really did come home to find Harold dead in her bathtub, just like she claimed. So now the theory is, Jerry finds Harold at Barbara's, kills him out of jealousy, moves the body behind the dumpster, and when he realizes what he's done, he confesses. Police thought, okay, maybe Jerry moved Harold's body and later felt too guilty to live with it, and now he's trying to correct the record. A new theory was falling into place, and now that police had a full-on confession. They finally had some direct evidence. A confession is proof enough. But that was just a written confession. It wasn't spoken. Jerry didn't come in and say anything to anyone. He hadn't called his lawyer, hadn't even told Barbara. He just mailed a random letter to police. And then a day later, on March 25th, 1978, the case took an abrupt turn. That afternoon, a tenant in Jerry's building called a maintenance man to say there was a loud clattering sound coming from Jerry's apartment and was really starting to annoy him. So around 3:20 p.m., the maintenance guy and the property manager entered Jerry's apartment to a pretty horrific sight. Jerry was in the bathtub, the broken overhead fan whirring loudly above him. His eyes were wide open with a small smirk across his face, and a purple tinge had started to coat his skin. Rigor mortis had already set in. A half hour later, his apartment was swarming with cops. The coroner found no signs of struggle, no bruises, no cuts. However, sitting on the toilet tank was an empty bottle of Valium. Their first impression? Suicidal overdose. But there was a lot that wasn't adding up. Neither the pathologist nor the coroner knew of a single instance of someone overdosing on Valium alone. Plus, there were other little things, like Jerry had shaved before entering the tub, he'd written a check for next month's rent, left out clean towels for himself, things he probably wouldn't do if he planned to never exit the tub. Why grab a towel if you're not getting back out? And remember, Detective Lolling had already warned Jerry a month earlier to distance himself from Barbara. He had said, she might try to kill you. So now, they started to collect every piece of evidence they could find. And soon enough, Lolling discovered another explosive detail. One that pointed directly at Barbara. Jerry had taken out a life insurance policy. And guess who the beneficiary was? Barbara Hoffman. Except here's what's strange. Jerry had made the first two premium payments, but the third payment was stopped. And the policy had lapsed a month before his death. Which meant Barbara wouldn't get a dime. And apparently she knew that, because she was the one who had stopped the third payment from going through. The whole thing was incredibly odd, but it got even weirder. Around April 7th, a member of the state crime lab named Kenneth Kempfert had been running a series of tests on Jerry's body, trying to determine if there was anything else in his system that may have led to his death besides the Valium. For days, Kenneth's work yielded no results, until April 7th, when it dawned on him, the body had a familiar yet unusual smell, burnt almonds. If you didn't know, burnt almonds are a telltale sign that the body had been poisoned with cyanide. It was the one test he hadn't yet run. But by the following day, he got the confirmation he was looking for, burnt almonds. Jerry had ingested twice the lethal dose of cyanide. So what did police do with this information? Well, they went back to some of the samples kept from Harold's autopsy, And when they ran the test on Harold, they found he also had cyanide in his system, 40 times the lethal dose. Two of Barbara's lovers, both dead, both poisoned. Both had life insurance policies naming her as beneficiary. Problem was, there was no evidence that she was the one who administered it. For all the police know, it still could have been Jerry that slipped the cyanide to Harold and then taken it himself once he realized what he'd done. A perfect viable theory until a new witness came forward. Someone who said he had valuable testimony against Barbara and he'd be willing to give it if police dropped a former charge against him. With Jerry Davies, their one key witness, now deceased, police were desperate to get any information they could on Barbara Hoffman. And what this new witness, William Garrett, what he had to say was pretty damning. William was the manager of Jan's Health Spa, so he worked closely with Barbara and her clients. And now he was saying Barbara had laid out her plans to him shortly before she stopped working there. He said she met a guy at the parlor, though it wasn't clear if she was referring to Jerry or Harold, and she had a long con. She was going to marry him, get her name on his life insurance policy, and then put her next phase into motion. She said that with her extensive background in chemistry, she knew how to culture a toxin that would lead to death. And once she completed the process, she'd take her new husband to Mexico on their honeymoon and administer the toxin, making it look like an unexpected illness. Then she'd collect the second payout. Now much of the testimony added up to detectives. Barbara had been engaged to both men. She had insurance policies out on both, except both died before any trips to Mexico ever happened. Despite some lingering questions in December of 1978, Barbara was also charged with killing Jerry Davies. A judge ruled that the murder charges for both men would be heard together during the same trial by the same jury. The day of the trial finally came, June 19, 1979. And frankly, Barbara had some pretty good evidence, or rather, lack thereof, stacked in her favor. And I'm not going to lie, Barbara's pretty smart. Like, she's clever, and it's kind of scary. So for starters, the defense argued that they had a written confession from Jerry, saying he was the one who had killed Harold. The letter was confirmed to be written in Jerry's handwriting, not Barbara's, in case that had crossed your mind. Excuse me. And I will say, handwriting evidence is not 100%. Not like it's not the most secure thing, but it definitely matters. Then there was the fact that Jerry's policy had been canceled prior to his death, particularly by a stop check made by Barbara. But she could have just done that because she didn't want to get caught for the first murder, so it was a good way to like cover herself up for the greed. However, the prosecution argued that this was a move suggested to her by her lawyer. They were like, no, she did this to make herself look less guilty. But if that was the case, then why follow through on the elaborate plan to kill the second man? Why even kill him and then not get the money? Especially because suicide, staged or not, would render any policy ineffective. Then there was the lack of DNA or any concrete evidence found in both Barbara and Jerry's apartments. Not a single fingerprint, hair, or spot of blood that conclusively say Harold was even in Barbara's apartment, or that Barbara was in Jerry's apartment before he died. Even more interesting, there wasn't any trace of cyanide ever found in Barbara's home. So they're like, where did the cyanide come from? And it turns out, Jerry himself had ordered the cyanide, which looks good for Barbara because this goes back to the theory that Jerry had done the killing. Except when they talked to the person who had taken the order for the cyanide for Jerry, he was like, no. Jerry was the name on the check, but it was a female who ordered the cyanide. So you have this testimony coming up, and I have to say, Barbara's parents came to the trial and testified, and they're like, no, we were with her on the night of the 23rd, which wouldn't make sense because where were they when Jerry showed up? Also, how could they have driven in the snowstorm? But they do come forward and testify that they were with her, trying to give her an alibi. And they only do this afterward. They don't tell the police this originally. They only say at a trial. Still, jurors take this and take everything into consideration. And by June 28, 1980, they come back with a verdict. On the charges of murdering Jerry Davies, the jury found Barbara Hoffman not guilty. On the charges of murdering Harold Burge, the jury found her guilty. She was sentenced to life in prison with the possibility of parole after 11 years. On July 3, 1980, Barbara was transported to the Tachita Correctional Institution in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. She was up for parole in August of 1991, but was denied. And as of this recording, Barbara Hoffman remains behind bars while maintaining her innocence, saying, quote, "I did not commit the crime of which I was accused and of which I was convicted." And with that, that is the case of Harold Burge and Jerry Davies. Let me know your thoughts on this case. Do you think she did it? Or do you think it was one of the people that were killed? And of course, if you want to support the channel, you can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/TCNS. As always, thank you so much for watching and listening. We will see you next time.